You're listening to the Leaping Cholla podcast, recorded in the Wrong Mountain Yurt in the Sonoran Desert.
I am falling away from this world. I am falling away from this world. You are calling me.
Okay, we're going.
Okay.
And we're reading Contributions to Philosophy of the Event by Martin Heidegger, and we're on section 76, which is called Propositions About Science. And in our last episode, we read 7 of them.
Yep.
So we're on number 8. Correct?
Mm-hmm. Let's just jump right in.
And I think we're going to jump right in. So, okay. Propositions About Science.
8. The organizing of knowledge, knowledge of an essential truth, experience in advance, is carried out as the building up and building out of an explanatory nexus whose possibility requires the thorough binding of the investigation to the respective subject area and indeed from the viewpoint into which the latter is shifted. This binding of the sciences as institutings of nexuses of correct findings is what constitutes the rigor proper to them. Every science is in itself rigorous according to the way it must be positive and the way it must individuate itself through the respective viewpoint it adopts toward its respective area.
Yeah, that seems pretty clear to me.
I still need you to like go through it. Remember we had this conversation?
No.
You were like, I don't understand unless you read it. I was like, yeah, I don't understand unless you read it.
Oh, okay.
So you can go through it really quickly, but I somehow need to like, to absorb it, need to like hear it said back to me.
So you're like the left hemisphere and I'm like the right hemisphere.
I don't know.
Of the brain, I mean, not of the... Well, so
What's the difference between left and right of the brain?
Oh, yeah. Well, that would mean you're like the logical thinker and I'm the creative thinker. I didn't really imply that, but I actually think that the left brain, right brain hemisphere thing has been debunked. But
oh, probably. Well, it's science.
What's science?
The left brain, right brain was science.
It was science for a while, and it's not anymore, yeah.
But that's what he's talking about is science.
That's right. But I was just not implying that I'm the right-brained person in the relationship and you're the left-brained one.
You are not? I thought you were.
No, I was just saying left-brain, right. You're on my left.
Oh, that's true.
I was just kind of, oh, look, there you are, the left, I'm the right.
Okay.
But I was not insinuating that I'm more creative than you.
Fair.
Although maybe I am. I'm kidding.
Well, you are like the interpreter and I'm like the speaker or something.
I think you're smarter than I am. I think you're more, how should we say, you're just way better at systematic learning, but I actually think you're more creative than I am.
Yeah, I think you're smarter than I am because I feel like I lack some like basics.
Nah.
My therapist actually said to me today that she thought I was brilliant.
Your therapist said that?
Yeah.
So she sensed you were about to leave therapy. No.
No, actually it was in the context of talking about that thing that happened with our friends in Harvard. And I brought up Harvard and then I explained my grudge against Harvard. Uh-huh. And I was like, just how frustrating it was to be like, I was the top of my class, but I didn't get to apply to it because we didn't have money to do the extra application. Yet somehow we didn't like qualify for financial aid.
Oh, and she
so I had like a grudge, and she was like, she just basically was like, well,
you're totally Harvard material.
I know.
You were totally
I totally was flattered by it. I mean, your parent, your therapist
course,
saying
that.
Of course,
so you're like, moving to once a week.
Yeah. No, I'm like blushing over here. Okay, sorry. I was like, oh,
your
wow.
Your therapist flattered you. That's just really...
Okay, anyways, let's move on.
The organizing knowledge... So in science, the knowledge of an essential truth experienced in advance.
Right. That's what I thought was knowledge of an essential truth experienced in advance. By the way, I want to point out we just did small talk, but like after we started the episode, that was kind of like organic.
It was organic. Yeah. I didn't think it was particularly small. It was kind of, I mean,
hugely brilliant.
Exactly. And you're brilliant. The organizing of knowledge. So the knowledge of an essential truth experienced in advance.
Like, that's cool, right? That's like kind of a cool way of putting it.
Putting yeah.
Something. I mean, I guess that's the organizing of knowledge.
Yeah, let's read the whole sentence. It says, the organizing of knowledge, and then I'll skip the parentheses, is carried out as the building up and building out of an explanatory nexus whose possibility requires the thorough binding of the investigation to the respective subject area, and indeed, from the viewpoint into which the latter is shifted. Mm-hmm. So I think he's just kind of saying that as science... I mean, in a sense, he's saying science is the organizing of knowledge. Well, the organizing of knowledge that is science is carried out by building up and building out an explanatory nexus that is only possible if it's thoroughly bound, if the investigation of it is thoroughly bound to its, you know, its proper subject area. Mm-hmm. And from the viewpoint into which its proper subject area is shifted, mm-hmm. Via the knowledge. So I think what he's saying is that because science is the organization of knowledge that involves an explanatory nexus that is bound to an area of investigation and to a viewpoint, then it sets up a situation in which essential truths are known in advance. Mm-hmm. Because it's kind of like, you know, you're setting up a framework that's going to determine what you're going to see.
Yeah.
And the essential truths which emerge from the explanatory nexus being bound to the respective area of investigation are established beforehand through the organization. Mm-hmm. And so you experience them in advance. They're kind of, you kind of posit them and give them and get, make them givens before the investigation even starts. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
This binding of the sciences, so this binding is the binding of the investigation to the respective subject area, as institutings of nexuses of correct findings, mm-hmm. is what constitutes the rigor proper to them. So we always talk about how science must be rigorous.
Right, yes.
That is through the binding, the institutings of nexuses of correct findings. Every science is in itself rigorous according to the way it must be positive. And remember, that's the way in which it must... Mm-hmm. only handle or deal with those things that are posited in its area of investigation. And in a sense, posited is synonymous with assumed, mm-hmm. or taken for granted. Mm-hmm. And the way it must individuate itself through the respective viewpoint it adopts toward its respective area. So
Yeah.
Okay. Glad I could help.
Thank you. 9, the development of the rigor of a science is carried out in the method.
The scientific method.
Oh, yeah. I.e., in the way of approach, the adopting of a point of view on the subject area, and the way of proceeding, the execution of both the investigation and presentation. The way of approach brings the domain of objects in each case into a determinate direction of explainability, one which, as a matter of principle, already assures the inevitability of a result. There is always some finding.
Hmm. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, do you not?
I mean, science is a method. Established points of view, established approaches, established proceedings. And you have to follow these rules, these rigors, in order for it to be considered science. It's a very mm-hmm. formal practice, but there is always a result. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. It makes me think, like the determinant direction of explainability. It makes me think of psychology. Like, how did people get turned into a science? How did in order for thinking to be turned into a science, it had to be given, I guess, the pre-givens, the essential truths experienced in advance. And I never thought of it. I mean, I've always thought of science as of course, there are experiments and things prove things and blah, blah, blah. But actually, as he's saying this, it just makes it feel like it's all really kind of bogus. And it makes sense when you tie it to itself. But it's in a way, maybe an even more intent, obviously there's the whole Descartes, I think, therefore I am, which is the start, or not the start, a main tenet of the first beginning. But I feel like science in a way has made it even, it takes it even further almost. It's more extreme, because it's it has to be the nexus of correct findings.
Yeah, I had this exact same feeling as I was reading this.
Yeah.
You put it very well. That's right. It's sort of we're so in science that I've always just kind of taken its formality for granted. Mm-hmm. But it's these paragraphs have, it's almost like seeing the, it's like being an, becoming an astronaut. Mm-hmm. And you see the Earth from far away for the first time. And it's just a little blue ball. And you realize that it's just a little blue ball floating in space. But before that, you were so on the Earth and in the Earth that you just never had the perspective. And now I see that science is a determinate direction of explainability. That in a sense, I mean, is a very demarcated, very limited area of investigation. And I don't know, for lack of a better phrase, it's almost like it doesn't have to be that way, or it's become so formalized that one has to wonder where on its edges it's porous, how its formality has infected other areas of thought or types of thought or mm-hmm. how we think. But he's meditating on it, as he said he would do. Mm-hmm. And he's deconstructing it and exposing its operations and mechanisms in a way that really makes you kind of think, oh, I can kind of see outside science. I can see around science. I can see mm-hmm. other things that maybe I can see psychological opportunities or existent realms that science can't touch, or that mm-hmm. science has closed off, or mm-hmm. or you start to question, why am I so dependent on science? Mm-hmm. Now, certainly there are some things that science is good for, works, right? Science works a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. But there's also a lot of things that don't have to be as scientient. Mm-hmm. Or at least it gives the impression that this, the rigor that's applied to it, or the scientient rigor, is a choice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Psychology is very much, a very powerful example of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like,
Yeah, do you want to keep reading?
Yeah. The basic procedure in all explanation is the pursuit and anticipatory establishment of individual series and chains of continuous cause-effect relations. The machinational essence of beings, although not recognized as such, does not merely justify, but even requires in an increase without limit this thinking in causalities, which is assured of results. These causalities, strictly speaking, are merely if-then relations in the form of when this, then that. Here also belongs the statistics of modern physics, which in no way overcomes causality, but simply brings to light its machinational essence. The opinion that living things can more readily be grasped with this apparently free causality simply reveals the hidden basic conviction that even what is alive will one day be placed within the jurisdiction of explanation. This step lies all the closer in view of the fact that on the side of the region opposite to nature, i.e. in history, what predominates is the purely historiological or pre-historiological method, which thinks entirely in terms of causality, makes life and any lived experience accessible to casual calculation.
Causal.
To causal calculation, and therein alone sees the form of historical knowledge. The admission that accident and destiny are co-determinative in history is all the stronger evidence of the exclusive dominance of causal thinking. Inasmuch as accident and destiny do present cause-effect relations, ones which merely resist precise and univocal calculation. Historiology could never recognize that historical beings might possess a completely different mode of being, one grounded on Dasein, because historiology would then have to renounce itself on the essence of history. For as science, historiology possesses for its pre-established operational domain that which is obvious, that which unconditionally conforms to an average intelligibility, and this intelligibility is demanded by the essence of science as the instituting of correct findings within the domination and regulation of all objects for the sake of their usefulness and breeding.
Yeah, that was it felt like one sentence, but it wasn't. So the basic procedure in this scientific explanation is to pursue and to anticipatorily establish individual series and chains of continuous cause-effect relations. So explanation is the establishment of series of cause and effect relations. Mm-hmm. The machinational essence of beings, so not the true essence of beings, but the machinational essence of beings, although not recognized as such, not recognized as machinational, does not merely justify, but even requires, in an increase without limit, this thinking in causalities, which is assured of results. So machinality, machinational essence, is in bed with thinking causally.
Mm-hmm.
They benefit each other. They are in cahoots. These causalities that machination relies on and establishes, strictly speaking, are merely if-then relations in the form of when this, then that. So if this happens, then that happens, and this becomes this massive nexus of instituted explanations and causes. So you know that if something happens, then something else happens, or if you're going to do that, then the other thing, then we know what's going to happen. And so everything becomes very, very fated, very, very established, very predictable. Yeah, the statistics of modern physics is just another form of causality. The opinion that living things can more readily be grasped with this apparently free causality. So the idea that we can understand living things through the nexus of causalities reveals the hidden basic conviction that even what is alive will one day be placed within the jurisdiction of explanation. So even things that are living will be juridified by explanation and kind of reduced to scientific explanation. This step lies all the closer in view of the fact that on the side of the region opposite to nature, i.e. in history, so I guess history is the region opposite to nature, what predominates in this region is the purely historiological or prehistoriological method, which thinks entirely in terms of causality. It makes life and any lived experience accessible to causal calculation, and therein alone sees the form of historical knowledge. So we've talked about historiology as, in a sense, the stories taken for history. Here he adds to that the determinants of what is historiology, and says that it's about causality and determining life and lived experience according to causal calculations. The admission that accident and destiny are co-determinative in history is all the stronger evidence of the exclusive dominance of causal thinking, inasmuch as accident and destiny do present cause-effect relations, ones which merely resist precise and univocal calculation. So accident is the word used for when something wasn't meant to happen, but it does. So it seems to step out of the causal chain. And destiny is a word for things that just were meant to happen, almost had been laid out since the beginning of time. And again, seems to be outside the causal nexus. But as Heidegger points out, that they are actually just part of the cause-effect relation. But they just are thought to resist a precise calculation. Historiology could never recognize that historical beings might possess a completely different mode of being, as he says, one grounded on Dasein, because historiology would then have to renounce itself, which it's obviously not going to do. So we have this, we see this, is now this juxtaposition between historiologically, the historiological mode of being, and the Dasein mode of being. And I would say that's probably just, you know, machinated being versus bang. Or human being in the throes of machinated being versus human being in the appropriation by bang. For as science, historiology, so historiology is science, possesses for its pre-established operational domain that which is obvious, that which unconditionally conforms to an average intelligibility. And this intelligibility is demanded by the essence of science as the instituting of correct findings within the domination and regulation of all objects for the sake of their usefulness and breeding. So we have this image of science kind of dumbing everything down. In order for it to be intelligible, conformative, operational, useful, breedable, all right? So it dominates and regulates all objects.
Shall I talk?
Please do.
I mean, one thing I find really interesting in saying the causalities are if-then relations is that, like, all of my intrusive thoughts are like, what if something, this happens? And so that's an if. So I'm just adding like a what in front of it. But it's really like a fear of a causality. And I believe I've read in some book that, like, I think all anxiety, like anytime something starts with what if, you're supposed to be like, oh, that's anxiety. Like, so, I mean, it's a very common lead up, you know, what do you call it? What's that, like, pickup note to anxiety?
Yeah.
So I just find it curious.
Yeah.
That
it's a pickup note to anxiety, yeah. How'd you know that term? It's pretty amazing. You played flute.
I did, yeah. I was.
Yeah, but
in
I thought
band.
You stopped at like eighth grade.
Yeah.
You don't remember when you stopped?
Actually, I think I did ninth grade.
Wow. And you picked up some music theory in junior high. No, you're an astonishing student.
Brilliant, obviously.
No, an astonishing student. Yeah. Yeah.
I also think the accident and destiny is really interesting.
Again, I think really, like you're full of interesting thoughts. I think your therapist infused you with a kind of brilliance. No, that's really well put. I mean, I think that if what Heidegger is really saying here is thinking has become the instituting of causal nexuses.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, very few of us think purely intentionally. We actually just kind of, our thinking just kind of runs,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Like a script and a hard drive.
Mm-hmm.
It's just always running.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we catch the train and say, oh, I'm thinking. And sometimes we don't catch the train and it just keeps going. So mm-hmm. our thinking is always going.
Mm-hmm.
And so when this what if occurs to you, you know, I would say you're infused and infested with mobilized causal nexuses that are churning away all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's the pattern of thought. It's the rhythm of your being, right? It's the mm-hmm. it's the constant info loop that is you, as you have become scientiated and terminalized by causative patterns of explanatory the directions of explainability. And you know, I think that's for anxiety, that's a really important bit of knowledge to have, that this thought train is composed of what if, mm-hmm. or of if then sort of synapses,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
These if-then synapses are firing constantly. They're nodes in the AI deep learning system of your brain, right?
Yeah.
And they're constantly firing, and they're constantly deciding which direction to go. And you know, they fire all the time, and sometimes they fire these drastic ones, like mm-hmm. what if I picked up that knife, and et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
What if I jumped?
Mm-hmm.
And so that would seem to imply in a very kind of mundane way that the liberation from anxiety involves a divorcing from these causal nexuses that have come to be called thought.
Mm-hmm.
That this idea that science will set you free, that understanding causation is the secret to knowledge, mm-hmm. that the lived experience, the calculated life or the calculated lived experience is the only one worth living, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that total cheesy bromide of what is it the investigated life is the only one worth living. What's that phrase? Mm-hmm. It's a cliche, right? The whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's just a philosophical ideological imperative, you know, like, oh, you have to learn and investigate yourself through the liberal forms of knowledge that philosophy has handed us, or your life mm-hmm. isn't worth living. It's just, you know, it's terrible stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That causal chain is beyond you. That causal chain is running you. That causal chain is it? Remember that? Remember that friend we had who said that the kind of the internet data in the sky was causing her skin to mm-hmm. crawl out of itself. Mm-hmm. Right? It's just kind of that kind of stuff. It's like
mm-hmm.
it's the representational nexus of meaning that mm-hmm. we have mm-hmm. come to believe in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just in the back of the head sometimes with what if statements that, mm-hmm. that scare the piss out of us. Mm-hmm. If we believe in that whole nexus, that's mm-hmm. the thing. Mm-hmm. If we leave that nexus, if we say, oh, that nexus is just a lot of if then mm-hmm. statements, mm-hmm. right? That I don't need to have any kind of relationship to, mm-hmm. then mm-hmm. it reminds me a little bit of my sort of assertion that, you know, it's like when like Buddhism and Christianity and yoga and these like Judaism, all these early religions, you know, these religions from like 3,000 years ago were establishing themselves and establishing spiritual codes, establishing cosmologies, establishing arcs of personal development, establishing patterns of how to identify and become the God, how to follow the God, mm-hmm. all this spiritual architecture of liberation that these religions handed to us. They were constructed in a time of such utter lawlessness,
yeah,
utter chaos, utter no medicine, you know, mm-hmm. no dentistry.
Ibuprofen.
Very little defense from wild animals that came up and like stole your baby. Yeah. You know, tigers eating babies, getting bit by highly poisonous snakes that kill you. I mean, it was just criminals, Vikings coming down the coast and, you know, raping and killing everybody. You know, it's just like life was, and so infused into these spiritual systems that could have remained purely spiritual systems were rules of behavior, laws mm-hmm. of behavior, mores, mm-hmm. Dictates of ethical mandate. Mm-hmm. And so now as we perpetuate this spirituality 3,000 years later in a society that has become, that whose legalities and civic institutions have become incredibly embedded and formalized and almost, you know, sort of they operate around us and we walk around so peacefully and mm-hmm. so preservedly within their safety net. Mm-hmm. But yet our spirituality is still infected with mm-hmm. these rules that they needed back then. So this causal thinking, this nexus of explanations, had its time, had its place, has its place in many areas, but it's so infused into every area, into mm-hmm. everything, that it's really now, I would say, that the in our era, the task of liberation is to decouple mm-hmm. areas of life from this causal nexus. And, you know, mm-hmm. if you don't do that, then that causal nexus is going to continue to hit you over the head with terrifying what-if statements, if-then mm-hmm. statements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I feel like I feel like there's something about the what-if statement that is almost like a what-if causality is real. What-if, like, I think we've discussed something like this before, but just like it's almost just a fear of the power of liberalism or language or representation, beings abandoned by being. Like, what if beings abandoned by being are real? That I think on some level that's part of the fear.
I hate to ask this, but what do you mean by real? And why would beings abandoned by being not be real? Or what's real?
I think the beings abandoned by being are real. I mean more just that like the power of the causality is greater than the power of not engaging in the causality.
Yeah.
The causality will win.
Yeah. I mean,
the what if will win.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like the causal nexus is like an electrical power grid. And every node is infused with the power of all the nodes. Mm-hmm. So it does feel powerful and it does feel like it can win. It always mm-hmm. wins and it is always winning. I mean, You know, it has to do with a little bit of that idea of the unrestrained possibility that has become so common to liberalism. And that unrestrained possibility is the electricity in the grid. That is the power at each node, is that each node is infused with all possibilities. And so we invest our adaptability and our vulnerability in this grid to varying degrees. How that investment takes place is an important question. It's sort of, I would say it's one of the crux issues of anxiety, is in what way do you become invested in this causal nexus and in the infinite power levels of the all possible that make up its electrical vectors. And how to, again, decouple from it and step away from it and let its power exist, but unplug. Unplug from it. How do you do that? You know, that kind of thing. But you said real. I mean, yeah. I don't mean to harp on the word real, but I mean, it's all very real, isn't it? But I sense what you meant was, again, if it's what if then that, that's what he says in if then statement, is this what if this then that, right? That energy arc there, that little synapse, the firing of that synapse, is empowered by the certainty that the system has invested into that outcome. Right? And so if you're invested in that outcome, if you're a believer in that system, if you're a liberal working, you know, enthralled to that system, then that firing is going to be really unquestionable. And if what if this, then that, if you even just meditate on what if this, then you're already experiencing then that. So yeah, he talks in here about like experiencing, what does he say? Yeah. It was the very first sentence we read, right? The organizing of knowledge, the knowledge of an essential truth experienced in advance.
Yeah, right.
So you're already experiencing the then that. Because the knowledge has become organized as a causal nexus whose energy is rampant and in a sense is directly related to your investment in it. In a sense, we are the ones empowering, we are the ones charging that electrical grid with our belief and investment in it. Because by the way, science can exist without being thought. Your thought doesn't have to be science. It's just that we've given in to science being our thought. And, you know, it's no accident that liberalism is now apparently the party of science. And science has gained religious status. And liberals are now fighting for science, et cetera. And that's because they're fighting for the thought system that keeps them in power and has their lived experience and their machinated being gives them sense. They're invested in that causal nexus to the ends of their being. So this disinvestment is in the realm of anxiety. I'd say this disinvestment from the causal nexus power grid is very important, right?
Yeah.
How do you do that?
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, it strikes me that if this whole nexus is synonymous with thought, then one way to decouple is to develop habits of thought styles of thought, experiences of thought that feel as if they're outside that nexus, mm-hmm. to cultivate mm-hmm. those kinds of thoughts. I mean, mm-hmm. that's in a way what this book is trying to teach us is, mm-hmm. he uses the word meditate again and again, but you know, he's trying to teach us how to use the refusal mm-hmm. and the restraint, yeah. right? And the, and listen for the resonating and for the leap and to take the leap mm-hmm. and to look for the last God. These are all actually just lane markers for trying to think outside the causal nexus that has become thought. Mm-hmm. To think differently.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
Should we, the next one is
the
really...
The next one is huge.
It's really huge. Yeah. Should we maybe talk about some other things?
Sure. The next one says liberal a number of times.
Does it really?
Or at least twice.
Well, maybe we should save that for next time.
Okay.
Right?
Yes, yes.
I mean, there's a little something that I had that I wanted to bring up.
Okay.
I had a very weird experience a couple of days ago. I've been reading analytic philosophy. So this is philosophy, very weird for me, very new to me. You know, as everybody knows, there's continental philosophy and analytic philosophy.
What?
Continental philosophy and analytic philosophy in the Western tradition. Continental philosophy is the philosophy practiced on the European continent. So the Germans and the French and the Italians, et cetera. And analytic philosophy is largely the Anglo-American tradition. So the Brits and the Americans tend to do analytic philosophy. The biggies in the analytic philosophy are Bertrand Russell, a Brit, Wittgenstein, who technically, I guess, was Austrian, but he lived most of his life in England. And then some Americans, you know, like Quine. So I've been reading some analytic philosophy, and largely to sort of investigate identity. And this analytic philosophy reading stuff had found me going largely in the direction of what's called modal logic, modal philosophers. And these modal philosophers are what I would call, like, they have become in the last 50, 60 years, you know, the sort of the leading strain of analytic philosophy, and they're kind of like the pure analytic philosophers. Like they're at the very core of analytic philosophy, really trying to solve the logical problems inherent in what analytic philosophy is. And they're the modal logic, and modal logic deals with essentially the questions of what is necessary, what is possible, and what is contingent. Mm-hmm. So what has to be, what could be, and what is only because something else is. Mm. That's contingent. Mm. And I was I'm on my fourth modal logic philosopher, you know. I'm scouring through the books, and it's very complicated because half their books, if not more, are in symbolic logic, which I continue to kind of not really take the time to learn. Mm. I've tried to take some time, and I understand some of it, but I don't understand it fully. But there's still a lot of just English. And I was reading one of the modal logic books that I'm on right now, which is by a guy named David Lewis. I believe his name is David Lewis. Let me see here. So essentially the leading modal logic philosophers are Saul Kripke, David Lewis, Alvin Plantinga, and in a certain sense, this guy, His name is, I'm reading two of his books now. His name is Timothy Williamson. And as I was listening to David Lewis, who writes a book called Possible Worlds, on Possible Worlds, I was like, you know, this really reminds me, all these guys, Kripke, Lewis, Plantinga, and Williamson, all remind me of St. Thomas Aquinas, the scholastic philosopher of the Middle Ages. Mm. They have the same kind of approach of like, it's like they're talking about God. Like they're mm-hmm. talking about a cosmological architecture that exists outside of us and is the form that the universe takes. Like they're that absolute about it. Mm-hmm. And it struck me how kind of pseudo-religious it felt in a very medieval way. And so I looked at it and, you know, it was astonishing because I discovered that all four of these guys are actually the children of, the children of highly religious people.
Wow.
So Kripke's parents ran the Orthodox synagogue in their town. Lewis's dad was a preacher. Plantinga's parents were, and Plantinga himself is a Christian theologian and a logician. And Williamson's father was a teacher at Jesus College at Oxford. They all come from really strict religious backgrounds. Wow. And so some of the story is, you know, I've been reading all this very complicated logic to investigate the question of identity. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that the people who are kind of furthering the logical language and rules that perpetuate the idea of identity are all very grounded in religion. And that's fine. I don't disparage them that, but it made me realize how the vibe of religion and religiosity mm-hmm. infuses all of this stuff. And I would say that this modal logic is as central to contemporary philosophy as it is like the skeleton of liberalism. Mm-hmm. That's what I would say. Mm-hmm. What I discovered is that the skeleton of liberalism is very religious. Mm. That's what I would say.
That's really interesting. So the philosophy is basically the philosophy of identity, explaining how identity is, or?
There's not a lot of talk of identity per se among these people. Uh-huh. Identity is the first law of logic. Uh-huh. And they would all say that logic is not impossible without identity. And by
it
which
is not or is
not possible.
Okay.
I mean,
oh, right.
And that's logic only because, you know, if A that. Is not A, how the hell are you supposed to write a logical formula? You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like logic is an attempt to establish an objective language of truth that is built on the law of identity. So yeah. they don't run around questioning the law of identity. But listen to this. So David Lewis, one of the biggest modal logicians, has a book called, and I'm kind of reading it now, or rather listening to it, but it's called On the Plurality of Worlds. And it's essentially... David Lewis, a prominent philosopher, is best known for his modal realism, which posits that all possible worlds are real, concrete entities that exist in the same way as the actual world. This is a highly respected philosophical theory. When I hear it, I just think, okay, this is science fiction. Mm. He argues that these possible worlds are not mere abstract ideas or thought experiments but rather they are real concrete places just like our own. Lewis believes that possible worlds are not abstract or fictional constructs, but rather concrete and real. He suggests that there is an infinite number of possible worlds, each representing a distinct way that the world could have been. So this guy basically says that there is an infinite number of worlds, all concrete, real places. Okay?
Okay.
And that our universe, or the world we live in, is just one of these infinite ones. And there's no, you know, the tendency would be to say, oh yeah, of course there's all these possible worlds, like how things could have been. I could have never met you and I could have gone here and this, and that's a possible world. He's like, no, these possible worlds I'm talking about are as real as ours, as concrete and as vast and as, like, there's possible worlds where there are no, there's worlds where any possibility, and they're infinite because it literally, there's a world just like ours, but in that world, humans have four toes, but everything is else is exactly the same. And history has gone exactly as it's, so it's obviously.
So it's like the science of infinite possibility.
Yeah, it's infinite beyond belief.
Yeah.
Right? And this is a highly respected theory, okay?
Yeah.
Which I find absolute. I mean, I'm not alone. I'm sure I find it absolutely insane. But you know, you can see. But I thought about possible worlds with because you and I talk a lot about possibility, and I think that Lewis's theory is just, in a sense, an extreme, exaggerated version of what liberalism has kind of settled into, which is that the possible isn't just conceptually or abstractly possible. It isn't just a different way of explaining what might happen. So it's not just a linguistic resonance or a linguistic artifact. The possible is, first of all, it's infinite, and all possibilities, there are all worlds, any world you can imagine is, any possible world you can imagine is real and concrete and it exists. And, you know, that is kind of, I mean, it's kind of overwhelming, I guess. Yeah. I mean, if you believe that, and I don't think a lot of people would really necessarily believe that, but actually maybe a lot of people would believe that. But it is such a reification of the possible, that the possible isn't even anymore just a way of thinking. The possible is everything, every possibility is actually an entirely other world that we now must consider as
it is real.
As real and concrete.
Yeah.
And so possibility has become, it's become worldized.
Yeah.
And, you know, this world we live in, so when you are facing a possibility, like what if then that, right? I mean, there's a world in which you do pick up that knife and you do kill yourself and your family. That world exists. It's concrete, according to one of our leading philosophers. And I would say that if it really is concrete, or it is, if it is real and that world exists, now he goes on and on about how these worlds do not relate causally, that there's really no relation between them. Which again, it's just absolutely stupid. It's just like stupid science fiction that you can even use logic to talk about these things. But again, very highly respected philosophy. You know, I wonder if in the world that we live in, if the resonances of this possible worldification affects us. Because it seems to me that you, when you think, oh, what if I pick up the knife and hurt myself? That's a possible world.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say to you, oh, you know, that's just a thought. It's an abstraction. It's a nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like you're almost actually experiencing it as if part of you has stepped into that possible world,
mm-hmm.
and it's concrete and real.
Mm-hmm.
And you're experiencing that way. And that's why it's so damn scary, because
mm-hmm.
there's like a wormhole between these two worlds. And now mm-hmm. you're like living half in that possible world, or at least mm-hmm. watching yourself living in that possible world.
Well, it's sort of like the if then causality.
Yes.
Yeah,
that's right.
Because just by thinking it, then you're suddenly there.
Right.
Or your mind has gone there, or something has taken you there into the other world.
Right. Right. So, I don't know. I thought that was a pretty interesting, because, you know, obviously how the possible world philosophy and the ramifications of it into logic and modal philosophy and epistemology, that's a whole nother topic. But I thought just the way in which logic has become, in a sense, a religion and is being mm-hmm. propagated and formulated by these people with deep religious histories and sentiments
mm-hmm.
Is not surprising to me. Mm-hmm. And the staunchness with which identity is defended is not mm-hmm. at all surprising to me when you realize that it comes from a religious basis.
Mm-hmm.
And the religiosity of liberalism that people are talking about now, I think is very linked to all of this.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of all, huh?
Yeah, that's just like really bizarre.
Yeah, that's kind of all I wanted to say. I just wanted to bring it up.
Yeah. I mean, are you like, well, it is a possible world or it's not a possible world? Are you just like, that's just like a total joke?
I think it's a total joke.
Yeah.
I do. I think it's, that's why it was reading Lewis that I was like, this just reminds me of like scholastic philosophy, again, St. Thomas Aquinas, from the Middle Ages, where they talk about, you know, the levels of heaven and the mm-hmm. angels. And
yeah, it feels very, yeah.
It's such a vast universal cosmology yeah. of like unobservable things that these philosophers are asserting, that it's just like, what in the hell is going on?
Yeah.
What are these people talking about?
But it's science.
I mean, I don't know if it's science. I mean,
yeah.
You're right. It's put forward as science, yeah. But it's actually science fiction.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, so...
Yeah, it's interesting.
I took it as like an interesting salvo in the epistemo-historic forms that surround us and infuse us and inform so much of what we read and think and are told and taught
mm-hmm.
That might have something to do with how invested we become, even against our better judgment, with the causal nexus
mm-hmm.
of directed explainability. Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
So I guess that's it.
Yeah.
Is that all?
I think so.
Yeah. Nothing else to say?
I mean.
What? Come on.
No, I mean, I like my mind's blank. I don't know. I can't think of anything, and it is, you know.
It's getting late.
It's late. Okay. It is literally our bedtime right now.
It's our bedtime right now. So once again, Leaping Trail Podcast, bedtime stories.
That's funny.
Leaving Joy Kai is a bedtime. It's a bedtime philosophy story. Actually, I was reading Goodnight Moon to our son tonight, and I was like, you know, I'm going to go through this goddamn children's library that we have and get rid of all the bad books, because I could read Goodnight Moon every night,
and
I'd love it because it's a good book.
Yeah.
And then the bad ones come up, and I'm just like, why am I reading this piece of crap?
Great.
So I just feel like, you know, there's probably like 20 children's books that are good literature, and we should just read those and throw away the rest.
Yeah, I agree.
Speaking of bedtime stories.
I agree. I mean, we have an insane number of books.
There's so many bad little children's books, man. I don't know. Is that a good note to end on?
Yeah. Good night, Moon.
Good night. Good night, Mush. Good night, Lady Whispering Hush. Good night, Nobody.
Right.
Good night, Noises Everywhere. Something like that. Good night.
Apparently, you need to read it more.
I do. I want to read it more.
How do you not know it?
You know, he just is finally starting to let me read books.
Yeah, I know.
To
it's
him.
Been a while. Yeah.
He's young, and book time for him has been him sitting there turning the pages really fast. He loves turning the pages. He's not really interested in what's on them. Yeah. But now he really sits and listens.
Yeah.
You know, to a story. Sorry.
Yeah, we have to face that at some point.
We have to face that we want to
remove all books that have stories.
No, see, I think that's a little...
Oh, right, we're not doing that.
Well, that's a little bit about disinvesting from the causal nexus. Like, the causal nexus is going to exist. I like to think that we can read to our children and realize that, and they can realize too, that there are stories being brought into the space, but we don't need to invest in them or get enthralled in them or let them control us in the way that they otherwise might, that we can, because again, like we can't shelter them from story.
Yes, yes, that's true.
What we need to teach them to do is to live in a world of story, but not be infected with story.
Yeah.
So that starts at the storybook, I think.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And good luck to us.
Yeah, we'll have to think about how that's possible.
We'll have to make a plan.
We'll have to make a method.
All right. Good night.
Good night.
Thanks for joining us for the Leaping Choya podcast. For more information, visit leapingchoya.com and be sure and follow us on socials. Until next time.